Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather around the radio. It's time for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show, lots of good people involved. And the host and founder of the program is Carol Marks. Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she is indeed a champion in the battle against ageism. Let's kick the program off right now with Carol Marks in conversation with Dr. Susan Forward. Susan Forward, Ph.D. She's one of the nation's leading therapists, as well as a best-selling author, sought-after lecturer, and frequent talk show guest. She's going to talk to Carol about her new book titled Mothers Who Can't Love, A Healing Guide for Daughters. It's published by HarperCollins Publishers.
Now, you said that you've written Mothers Who Can't Love partly as a result of your own mother's inability to be a consistently loving and supportive parent, but instead had an overwhelming need to be admired, even saw herself as your rival. So what effect did this have on your confidence and your sense of self-esteem?
The same effect it has on almost everybody who has a highly competitive mother who needs to shove them out of the limelight, get themselves in there, compete with them in every arena of their lives, whether it be professional or personal. My mother used to flirt outrageously with my boyfriends, ask them to play golf with her, ask them if she could go to dinner with them, and it first of all put an enormous amount of inadequacy in me, and then an enormous amount of rage, because when your mother, who's the person who's supposed to be safe and protective and supportive, is suddenly not your mother anymore, but she's like a big sister who's your rival, it's very confusing, and it's very, very disturbing. And because of her behavior, which could vary from very loving and a lot of fun and very loving and kind and nice to this getting in the boxing arena and putting on the gloves, it was bewildering. I didn't know what I had done to bring out the bad mother. She was a good mother sometimes, but somehow I lost her. And so my sense of what had happened, I blamed, as almost every woman does, who has a mother who is unloving in any way, whether it's narcissistic or enmeshing, or she becomes very infantile and dependent, I blame myself.
And don't you think that the daughters also who have an unloving mother cling to the belief that things will get better?
Oh, yeah.
That's not helpful.
If I can just find the magic key, she will love me. If I can just figure out what I'm doing wrong and how to be nice and better, she will be the mother I always wanted. It's a very destructive hope because, first of all, you are automatically set up for disappointment, because unless she comes to some kind of terms with the fact that she has a big responsibility here that she's not meeting, nothing's ever going to change.
And in the 35 years that you've been a psychotherapist, you've seen lots of women with unloving mothers, and you write, tending to marry someone just like them. So what characteristics can that result in their developing, and can they even become a battered adult or an abusive mother?
Yes, of course. It's not automatic, because sometimes people who have been abused in some way or other really do determine to themselves that they will not follow that behavior, and they're successful at it. On the other hand, some women who have been abused by their mothers will very often, whether it's a psychological abuse or a physical abuse, will very often replicate that pattern, because your mother is your role model. That's who you're supposed to bond with and identify with. And if you identify with a cruel or rejecting or cold mother, or highly critical one, chances are that unconsciously you may very well bring into your life the kind of man that will allow you to replicate that behavior in the hopes that this time it's going to come out different, except it never does.
Now, in your book, in the first half, you talk about the different kinds, categories that mothers can fall into. And in the second half, you give lots of steps and strategies that will allow you to change your relationship with your mother and have a better life. And one of the tools that you talk about is an exercise. It's called Lies and Truth.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it about not accepting some of your mother's messages as truth, but instead realizing they're false beliefs? So can you give us a couple of examples of false messages and how they can really
How about you never amount to anything, or you're lazy, or your nose is too big? I mean, I could go on and on, as every woman who has been put down, criticized, made to feel small, less than, particularly as a child, who has taken these messages inside herself, not as the opinion of somebody else who may be disturbed, who may be very unhappy in her own life, but as the truth. And so what I do with the exercise is I have people take a piece of paper, draw a line down the middle. On the left-hand column, they put lies, and they write as many things as they can remember, and believe me, they don't have any trouble, that were cruel and hurtful and wounding. And on the other side of the paper, they put the counteracting truths. Now, that's tough for them because they don't believe them yet. They are still under the sway of their mother's messages. But I'll never amount to anything. Sorry, Mom, the truth is that I have become successful. I have become very prominent in my job. I am having a decent life despite you. And that is where we're going. That is not necessarily what's true now, but if they do the work they need to do and they do this acknowledgement, make the decision about what they're going to do about their mother, because, you know, you mentioned to make a better relationship. Of course, that's the ideal thing, but that may not be possible. And if it isn't, and they cannot have a good life with their mother in it, they may have to break up that relationship and cut her off emotionally and physically from their lives.
But the lies and truth exercise, I think, is an excellent way of getting started in exploring that important relationship in your life. And you've also said that letter writing is a very effective way to get to the heart of somebody's troubled relationship with an unloving mother. So why is writing that letter important? And should they send the first letter they write to their mother?
No, I give them very specific instructions. You don't send the letters. You read them aloud to me. And what that does is it takes what is internal, where, of course, it has enormous poisonous effects, the hurts, the wounds, because the first section of the letter is entitled, "This is what you did to me." The second section is entitled, "This is how I felt about it at the time." The third section of the letter is, "This is how it affected my life." And the fourth section is, "And this is what I want from you now." And believe me, there are a lot of tears shed, which is good, when women start to get in touch with how badly they were mistreated. They never wanted to really acknowledge it. And when you put it down in black and white on paper, you externalize it, where the demons have a lot less power over you, and you start to see the truth in front of your eyes.
Now, don't most women, you know, in facing the truth about the inadequate mothering they've had, have feelings really both of grief and anger? And you say that they're two sides of the same coin and that you can mold them together to create a new kind of resilience. So why are they two sides of the same coin?
Because grief is very often a way that people cover up their anger because they're afraid of it. And anger is very often a way that people deal with grief, because grief is probably the most painful feeling there is. And people will do anything to avoid it, to go around it, to go under it. You can't do that. You have to face it. And once you start facing your grief and really acknowledging to yourself how mistreated you were, how neglected, how rejected, how coldly you were treated, how abusively you were treated, there's going to be a flooding of grief. That's why we don't want to talk about it. That's why the subject has been hidden for so long. That's why the "don't you dare say anything bad about your mother" mantra has kind of been the way we behaved. And once you start to realize that, no, this was not a woman who had the mother gene. This was not a woman who was capable, for either physical or psychological reasons, to give you what you needed. And you kind of had to grow up by yourself. And you kind of had to find your own identity. And you're floundering with it. And as an adult, you are very often not able to know. I hear women say all the time, "I don't know who I am. I don't know what I want." It's because they've never had that bonding that allowed them to develop a sense of confidence, a sense of dignity, a sense of self-respect, and they orchestrate much of the self-defeating behaviors from their own lives out of that lack.
Now, one Independence Day, you came up with a wonderful idea, and that was the Adult Daughters Bill of Rights. It's mentioned in your book, and people will have to get your book if they want to find out about all of them, because they're very interesting and helpful. Can you name one or two of them?
Yeah, you have the right to expect good treatment. You have the right to say no. You have the right to change your mind. There are so many rights that we don't give ourselves. We believe that somehow everybody else's needs come first. We're not allowed to stand up for ourselves because that's the way we were raised. And so what I'm trying to do, and in many cases have been extremely effective and successful, is to let these young women know, young women, middle-aged women, and very often older women, that all of this stuff that they believed and carried with them in their lives is something they can throw off, they can stand up for themselves, they can take their power, they can take what they're entitled to, and not continue to replicate the confusion and the chaos that they had growing up.
That's Susan Forward. Susan Forward, Ph.D., in conversation with Carol Marks. If you'd like more information, the book is titled Mothers Who Can't Love, A Healing Guide for Daughters, published by HarperCollins. For more information, go to SusanForward.com. I'm Michael Harris, and A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues with more conversations with Carol Marks in just a moment.
Did you know? An estimated 16 million Americans suffer from a chronic inflammatory facial condition called rosacea. And most of them don't know it? Often mistaken for acne, there are many signs and symptoms of rosacea besides facial redness, pimples, and visible blood vessels. Other symptoms may include burning, stinging, swelling, and even enlargement of the nose. Rosacea can also affect the eyes, causing a bloodshot appearance and irritation that could lead to vision loss. Any one of these signs and symptoms can mean rosacea, and without medical help, it can become increasingly severe and wreak havoc on your personal and professional life. Rosacea typically appears any time after age 30. So if you experience any sign of rosacea, see a dermatologist for diagnosis and treatment. Or for more information, visit the National Rosacea Society at rosacea.org.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. I'm the anchor, and the host of the program is Carol Marks. Here's Carol now in conversation with Katie Butler. She's an award-winning science writer, and she's going to talk to Carol about her new book titled Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. It's published by Scribner.
Now, the inspiration for your memoir, Knocking on Heaven's Door, came from the desire we all have to take control of the end of our life and all the complications, moral and otherwise, interfering with this process. And your memoir starts with your mother asking you, in 2007, to please help get your father's pacemaker turned off. And that was a pretty drastic request. So can you briefly tell us what happened to your dad in 2001 that led to his becoming gravely disabled?
Yes, my father lived an extremely vigorous and full life until he was 79, when he had a really crippling stroke that really robbed him of the capacity for speech or to take care of himself. And so my mother, which I'm sure is a position many of your listeners may be in or contemplate being in, became his full-time caregiver, and I became the caregiver on the other side of the country that flew in and out to help them out. And what happened was, a year after the stroke, when my father had essentially outlived his happiness once the stroke occurred. And he, in fact, said to my mother, "I'm living too long." It was very, very heartbreaking. But a year after the stroke, he was given a pacemaker in a kind of very, very rushed decision. And the pacemaker, unfortunately, kept him going for another 5.5 years, into a point where death would have been a blessing rather than a curse. So he did develop dementia. He did start going blind. He was already quite deaf and frankly, just miserable.
Now, you know that when you look at what a pacemaker is, it's really a seemingly minor medical decision, but isn't it true that there's no such thing as minor surgery when it comes to the frail and the elderly?
Absolutely. On two very different levels. On one is just the simple level of the danger, that the older you get, the more you risk cognitive decline if you have general anesthesia, the more likely you are to come back from the hospital worse rather than better, and the less likely you are to have the resilience to bounce back from something. The other point is, I think we all draw this line differently, but we have to start contemplating the question of, are we extending a life here, or are we prolonging a dying? And as you know, I mean, we all draw this line differently and have very different values, but it's very important for us to contemplate, because if we don't contemplate it, we may end up on a conveyor belt to a kind of death that we really want to avoid.
You are so right. Now, you just mentioned the fact that, you know, it was kind of a rushed medical decision to put the pacemaker in, and that happens so often. And so you advocate that what we should do, if at all possible, is when it comes to these decisions, use slow medicine. That's the way to go. So for those of us who don't know what this term means, what is slow medicine?
Well, in a nutshell, slow medicine is just slow it down. Slow down the decision making. Think very carefully about care rather than cure when cures become ungettable. So we have the term fast food and slow food. In essence, slow food is quality over quantity, and fast food is, we all know fast food. And when it comes to health, fast medicine is throwing the maximum number of procedures and tests at somebody and hoping that a few of them stick and that the result is better health. And slow medicine is more quality over quantity, and especially when we get older, this becomes more important. It could be, for example, that simply an adaptive yoga class or gait training to make sure that you are less likely to fall could be very, very helpful to someone elderly, whereas a major procedure like putting in a pacemaker, putting in a defibrillator, deciding whether or not to put in a feeding tube, all of these are very important decisions to slow down, because they have long-term implications both for your immediate health and also for this very important question of how do we get ourselves back to the good deaths that our ancestors really prized and prepared themselves for.
Now, one thing that I learned I found so interesting from your memoir was about all these new life-saving techniques and equipment that were developed in the 60s, and they all came about so quickly that it required a new kind of a hospital room, and that's how the intensive care unit got born. And then didn't that result in all these new machines in the ICU causing medical personnel, perhaps, to look at the body merely as a place for our organs that could be removed and replaced like spare parts, like a car.
Yes, exactly. When I was writing the book, that was really the analogy that came to me, that we so dehumanized the dying process or the care of the very, very, very sick. In the 60s, it was a remarkable watershed. And of course, it had tremendous benefits, because now if you're in a serious car accident, you have a very good chance of surviving, whereas before the 50s or 60s, you really didn't. And so, I never want to suggest that these were all bad things, but it's a question of applying them appropriately. And when someone is, for example, 70, 80, 90 or older and has multiple incurable illnesses, it becomes, doctors actually use the term torture, literally, medically sanctioned torture for what goes on in the ICU. And if you don't have a legitimate chance of surviving your hospital stay and returning to a really full life, I think it's very important to think through that question very, very carefully of whether or not you end up in intensive care. So it wasn't just the pacemaker, you know? It was the pacemaker,
so many things.
Internal defibrillator, the ventilator, dialysis. All of these things can postpone death, but almost none of them can actually restore you to a full life.
That's Katie Butler in conversation with Carol Marks. She's an award-winning science writer, and her new book is titled Knocking on Heaven's Door, The Path to a Better Way of Death. It's published by Scribner. Coming up in the program, our senior correspondent Steve Wiseman will be joining us, and he'll be talking with Jean Murray Walker, talking about her book titled The Geography of Memory, A Pilgrimage Through Alzheimer's. That's coming up in the next half hour, plus a lot more. Steve will be talking about the Affordable Care Act. I'm Michael Harrison. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver.
If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And we come to that point in the program where we are joined by Kevin Casey. Kevin Casey is not only a senior correspondent here on A Touch of Gray, but he is also the vice president and executive editor of Talkers Magazine. Talkers Magazine at talkers.com is a trade publication in the talk radio business. And talk radio is what you're listening to right now. So, Kevin, welcome back to A Touch of Gray. It's certainly good to talk to you. And you and I both were in Los Angeles last week at the Talkers Los Angeles 2013, the home of The Answer, where we're heard on A Touch of Gray at fine radio station KRLA. And a lot of people from around the country in the business were there talking about the big issues. What are some of the issues for our listeners that are of concern in the radio business these days?
Well, the big issue and all of its permutations is the future of radio and all that that implies. With the competition with the digital world, operators of radio stations or businesses that service radio stations are all concerned about the health of the business and where its future lies within the realm of all the media that's out there now.
One of the things that was discussed was the idea of live and local. And as a matter of fact, Larry Wilson, who is CEO of a company called L&L Broadcasting, L&L Broadcasting stands for Live and Local. He is a fellow who did very well during the earlier part of the century, in the 1990s and the 2000s, by building a company called Citadel and then selling it at the height of consolidation for over $2 billion.
Talk about good timing.
Good timing, and certainly a very wealthy man, a man of means. And then he disappeared from the industry for a number of years. And recently, a few years ago, he came back, started a company called L&L, Live and Local, and basically wants to bring radio, just not just talk radio, but talk and music radio, back to a point where there was more live and more local radio. Now, for people listening to this, most of them are listening on a talk station, and, well, I mean, this show is a syndicated show. It's not live, nor is it local, but it certainly serves a meaningful niche. You don't hear a lot of programs on the radio aimed at people over 50. Most of the programs on the radio are aimed at people under 40. So we do perform a service, as indicated by the fact we've been on the air for more than 22 years. That being said, fill us in on the state of live and local in terms of the broad radio scene.
Well, it's a gradually disappearing thing, is broad-based live and local programming, but there are operators, Larry Wilson among them, who do feel that live and local is the best way to compete in the greater media landscape, and there's a bit of a return to that. It's still kind of a niche thing, but that is happening in the industry, and a lot of people feel, if you ask them, that that is what radio needs to do to succeed, that it can do better than other media, which generally tend to be broader in their, you know, in their targeting.
What are some of the other issues that are of concern in the radio industry at this point?
Well, the cost of operation is certainly among them. If you're a talent, getting paid for your work is another one. There are issues that surround intellectual property, which is far beyond the scope of my knowledge to speak of, you know, in any detail, but that's huge as well, too. Just what do you own regarding your work? What does the station own? What of your work does the station own or your employer own? And these are all issues that are in flux and evolving in the court system, actually, as these kind of cases get tested.
One of the reasons for that is the multi-platform nature of media today, mm-hmm. where things are not just, you know, on a radio station at a certain time, but rather there's podcasting, there's Facebook pages,
yep.
there are streams. It's a very, very transitional period. And if people want to visit talkers.com, they can get a little bit of a peek behind the curtain and see what's going on in this interesting industry. I certainly appreciate you joining us on the program. Kevin Casey is the Vice President and Executive Editor of Talkers. He is also a senior correspondent here on A Touch of Gray. Thank you, Kevin. And again, it's talkers.com if you'd like to go behind the scenes and see what's happening in the talk radio industry at the trade publication that serves this business. I'm Michael Harrison. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in just a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and we're joined the rest of the way by our very learned and scholarly senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman, in conversation with Jean Murray Walker. She's a professor of English at the University of Delaware, and she's going to talk to Steve about her new book titled The Geography of Memory, A Pilgrimage Through Alzheimer's. It's published by Center Street Hatchett Book Group.
It's an interesting title, The Geography of Memory, and then A Pilgrimage Through Alzheimer's. Both of those. Why the geography?
Well, I think when I was inventing a title, because I had the whole book and needed to find a title, I was thinking of Alzheimer's almost as if it was a land, you know, a place to go or a place to be for a little while.
Interesting. And so the pilgrimage, and indeed with so many of us, it's not a short-term thing. It's a long-term. How long did your mother deal with Alzheimer's?
Well, the book covers a decade, and I think one of the dilemmas of a caretaker, and I know that some of your radio audience at least will be caretakers. Part of the dilemma is that you don't know exactly when it started. There's not a firm boundary. You don't get a diagnosis. And you also don't know when it's going to end because the journeys of so many different people are different.
Yeah. You know, and of course we all end up looking back saying, oh yes, now I look at, this or I look at that. With your mother, when did you first start to get enough inclinations that you were, that you needed to look into it more, and did she resist?
She resisted. She was, we probably began to have the sense that we needed to look into it maybe 8 years before she died, but she was a nurse and she was very successful at getting out from under a diagnosis. We tried with a number of different doctors, and eventually we just went with somebody who is a family medicine specialist who was really wonderful in the sense that he paid attention to what she said and gave her what she needed in terms of medication to keep her physically well. And I'm not sure, you know, that she ever really got a diagnosis, but it was very clear. She went to the Alzheimer's unit during the last 6 months of her life. So we didn't get a diagnosis, but I think the medical people agreed.
Now, it was kind of interesting because you commented on the fact of, and you talk about in the book, her history as a nurse, and even with her mind being taken away from her in some ways, she was still sharp enough, clever enough to kind of work the system while she's being diagnosed. And, I mean, you got to find that sort of, I guess, amusing or a little bit power for her at a powerless time.
Oh, yeah. I loved it. I mean, I would sit there and watch her, and it was a combination of flirting and being able to dimly remember the Alzheimer's test, you know, which words they were going to give to her to remember, and somehow she figured that out. I loved it that my mother got around the diagnosis, because I don't know that if she had been diagnosed she would have gotten better care, really. It was just a question of being able to put her in a category, and she was resisting that.
Yeah, it kind of keeps her humanity and her own personhood about her. Alzheimer's is a family disease. How did it affect your family?
Oh, well, one of the this book is a narrative, and one of the reasons I think I wrote the book was because I began to understand that my relationship with my sister, which had never been a bad thing. I mean, we just left school, the university, and went out and had our own families in different regions of the country, and we just really didn't know each other as well as we had as kids. And we had to work together to take care of my mother, and it became, we wrote 1,000 emails back and forth and phoned one another several times a week and had to come to some negotiation and compromise about some very difficult issues. And by doing that, I got to know her better, and our kids got to know each other. They're now raising families, and their children know each other, and it really knit the family together in a very powerful way that I don't know that anything else could have quite done.
Now, you mentioned this being a narrative, and I found that very interesting that your memoir of this narrative was different than, say, other family members. And did that surprise you initially?
Well, yeah, I think maybe I didn't quite understand when I started writing exactly what you're doing when you're writing about your own history. What you're doing is writing it from your own point of view, which is all you've got. It's really the only story you have to tell. But it isn't the same story as other members of the family have, and so they feel like their story is the story, and I think it is inevitable that depending on where you are in the birth order and what region you're in and whether you're close to your parent geographically or not, you know, all those things affect your point of view. So I was surprised when people read this and said, well, that's not the way I remember it.
Interesting. What kind of effects does the caregiving have on the caregiver? And I think people, even though they know it's stressful, they really don't appreciate until they've been there how difficult that is.
Yeah, it can be pretty isolating because it's hard to understand people who have Alzheimer's. They often don't refer to things in the literal world. And so you feel lonely if you're your life is slowed down because many times they have a walker or it's hard for them to get in and out of cars. And so your life is slowed way down. And then you can't always talk to them and make yourself understood. So, I think that for me, realizing that my mother was speaking frequently in metaphor and referencing stories that she had told me from her childhood, or even sometimes the years that I was at home and lived through, you know, in the family with her, I recognized some of the metaphors she was using. You could almost read her speech as if it was poetry, kind of surrealistic poetry, and that really helped a lot to prevent this kind of awful isolation.
Fascinating. I guess in closing, what would be your advice to others who are going through this in their own families?
Well, I think when I was going through it, I felt like it was a meaningless, repetitive slog because I didn't know how it would end up, and it felt like it was just the same thing over and over. Looking back, I see it as a pilgrimage or as a journey with different stages, and I would say hang on. You know, hang on with your family member. When the whole thing is over, I think it has a little bit more meaning for people than it does when you're going through it.
That's Jean Murray Walker in conversation with Steve Wiseman. The book that she has written is titled The Geography of Memory, A Pilgrimage Through Alzheimer's, published by Center Street Hatchett Book Group. And Steve Wiseman will continue to be with us for the rest of the show. He's going to be back in a moment talking about the Affordable Care Act when A Touch of Gray continues.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marx offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marx is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
The growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
Engines.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor seat, and here again is Steve Wiseman, our senior correspondent. Steve Wiseman is an attorney, he's an author, and he is one of the enemies of fraud. That's right, the scammers don't like Steve Wiseman. He has a website called Scamicide.com. Check it out. He's also written the book, The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall. Steve now joins us to talk about the Affordable Care Act. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. Well, the Affordable Care Act is with us now, and it just started on October 1st, and through March 31st of next year, consumers are going to be able to use a new system of health exchanges in each state. You can also go to the website www.healthcare.gov for information as to what you need to know about signing up, and if you need to sign up. Right now, in the early days, the website has been having some problems, some crashing, and maybe that's a good thing because what it's showing is a lot of people are going there. The Affordable Care Act is something that guarantees everyone access to coverage, and this is whether you're sick, whether you're healthy. It offers low and middle income people some help with their premiums. It is interesting to know that there are a lot of people to whom it will not apply. And particularly if you are a senior on Medicare, you are already covered. You have a plan that will meet the requirements, so you don't have to do anything more. Most most people who have a plan at work that their employers are covering will not, again, need to use the exchange or change their insurance. And the easiest way to find out is to just to talk to your HR people. There are about 7 million people who are expected to use the exchanges to buy private insurance. And it's important to know that if you are eligible, you should do it. Now, some states will have their own insurance exchanges. Others will have the federal. There are different levels of policy. The thing is that what we have are people called navigators, and these are people who are trained to assist you in choosing the policy, and not only choosing the policy itself, but also picking out what particular kinds of benefits you might be entitled to, because you might be entitled to various kinds of subsidies with this. The big thing is also to remember in regard to scams. These navigators are not going to be seeking you out. So if you get a letter, a telephone call, a text message from someone saying that they are a navigator and to provide them information, don't do it, because the real navigators are the people that you are going to contact through your state or the federal insurance exchanges or through the website. They will require some personal information, and they will need that to verify your eligibility for various plans. But when you are sure, either by going down in person or speaking to someone that you know is the real deal, you can really help yourself out. There's been a lot of criticism of the Affordable Care Act, and it's far from perfect, but it is something that is going to be of a great help to a lot of Americans.
Thank you, Steve. Interesting information. Steve Wiseman is a member of our senior correspondence team. And again, if you want more information about scams and fraud, check out scamaside.com. The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall, is one of many Steve Wiseman books. He also is known as Stephen J.J. Wiseman, Esquire. Thank you, Steve. And thank you, Beverly Santinello, our producer on the front line, putting it all together. Thank you, Carol Marks, the host and founder of the show. Thank you, Kevin Casey. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. We invite you to join us next weekend right here again. I'm Michael Harrison, your anchor. And we'd love to have you join us next weekend for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.